Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, CMPD and City Council take a new approach to lowering the violent crime rate, a data-driven approach. The Panthers get a new coach from an unexpected place. Matt Rhule comes from the ranks of college coaches. Ben Carson comes to town to announce a rollback of housing regulations. It's budget time again in Mecklenburg County, and citizens are busy filling out surveys to determine budget priorities. Plus, a new CMS website quickly shuts down. Our roundtable of reporters is ready to detail those and other stories, and seated around this very table are Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE News and soon to be co-host of our new Inside Politics podcast, which I believe starts on January 23rd. Is that right?
That's right. Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Katie Peralta is senior editor of Charlotte Agenda. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Jonathan Lowe is reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Hello.
Good morning, Mike.
And Eric Spanberg is back. He's managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
We're all on the radio. You can also watch us on Facebook Live this morning. We've been reporting on this station and elsewhere 108 murders in Charlotte for 2019, but the mayor told me yesterday that the number was revised to 107 because one of those murders was deemed justifiable. Still, that number is the highest it's been since 1993, and all of last year and the year before, CMPD and other officials fretted over how to get a handle on all of this senseless violence. On Monday, the police shared statistics with City Council, pinpointing violent crime hotspots. And Mayor Vi Lyles, who was on this program yesterday, said this new approach comes with the realization that the solution is not just about policing.
This is a national issue for urban areas. Cities that are successfully addressing this are doing it in a way that they use data analytics and they draw their conclusions and they put programs in place.
So this is not unlike, she said, an epidemiologist and how they pinpoint the outbreak of disease and then plot it on a map and figure out how to get a handle on it and cure it. So what will this data-driven approach allow us to do that we haven't been doing?
I mean, I'm still not really sure because a big part of the presentation Monday night, they identified these four violent crime hotspots.
Right.
If you've lived in Charlotte a long time, This was not a surprise.
Usual
and so it was like, okay, and, great, and we all know this, everyone knows this, and then there was a bit of a question of what's next,
right.
And then everyone seemed to kind of have their own agenda or their own ideas about what that would be.
And not just the crime hotspots, but the data that revealed that the people that are committing most of the crime are between the ages of 18 and 24. We heard that all last year. We consistently heard that every time we had a heinous murder, CMPD would come out and say this is the result of people settling minor arguments with violence. Again, to Steve's point, I really don't know what.
Yeah. Well, this goes back to before the holidays when we were talking about this on the roundup, and the fact that I kept saying, what do we need to study for? To tell us what's going on. We know where these things are. The police keep track of this. They've been keeping track of this since there was a police department.
Well, and I would take it a couple of steps further. I mean, the briefing that they gave to the media and then the presentation to the council Monday night, they've gathered all these statistics from various sources, and I mean, very little of it was surprising. The fact that the high crime areas tend to be in places where there is a lack of education, a lack of jobs, higher drug use, poor housing standards.
Prostitution.
There's nothing wrong with gathering these statistics and analyzing them, but there wasn't a whole lot new. And a couple of things I wondered about, there still hasn't been much discussion about the larger issues of the state and the legislature and going after problems such as a lack of judges, a lack of prosecutors, the police department being down roughly 10% of its force the last few years. Those things would seem to be just as important, if not more so, than what was discussed.
And also with the hot spots, as far as nothing being new or what was new, take, for instance, over at I-85 in Sugar Creek. I remember years back, CMPD was going to try to do something where they worked with the business owners in that area because The hotels that are in the I-85 Sugar Creek area are hotspots for crime, and so they were going to try to step up their enforcement there. So it's, but those hotels still exist, and they still have issues with crime over there.
That report identifies 13 hotels and motels along the I-85 Sugar Creek area that are catered to transient populations. That was
have a high propensity for crime
and for prostitution, which spreads out into drug use and armed robbery, et cetera, et cetera. Now we've had hot spots of prostitution in a block away from here not too long ago, and they took care of it. Why don't they just take care of it?
I think one thing. I mean, I was going with the hotel issue. I think it'll be interesting to see. Let's say if this conversation was happening 10 years ago about the Sugar Creek hotels, there would have been a big movement, I think, to identify the worst offenders, buy them out, demolish the hotel. I mean, the cities did that, two hotels across from Bojangles and Independence, Wilkinson. That would have been the idea 10 years ago. But, of course, in the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a big shift toward affordable housing. And those hotels, in addition to breeding crime, a lot of people live there, there are families who live there.
Okay.
So it's just interesting to see these issues we talk about and how the pendulum swings. So now what do you do?
I think the other – go ahead, Mike.
No, it's good. No, it's fine.
I was going to say that, you know, another thing that's interesting about this that could be positive or could be negative, it's hard to tell right now, is there is certainly more of a unified purpose or approach to this. You know, you heard Malcolm Graham at the swearing-in talking about how this is a public health crisis. There was mention of Gibby Harris, the Mecklenburg County Health Director, and what she has said in the past few months trying to work with Atrium Health and others. It's definitely a much more holistic approach, for lack of a better term, and it all ties into a lot of this economic mobility emphasis that you're seeing in county and city budgets. Again, I don't know if it's going to work, but it does seem like they're more on the same page.
It gets back to that epidemiologist analogy that was made yesterday on this program, the fact that this allows them to use data to pinpoint the problem and then figure out why that problem exists and then come up with solutions.
I was just going to say one more thing. I think it was interesting Monday night during the discussion. There was so much talk about all these kind of wide range of things, drugs, mental health, guns, et cetera, judges. But there was really council and city staff went out of their way to say, CMPD is doing great. We've got a great department. Everything's great. And, you know, my question is, well, you can have a great department, but maybe what you're doing is not perfect. And there was essentially no willingness to say, maybe our tactics are off. Maybe we should be doing something different.
Well, Julie Eisel, she's one of two people that I know about on council who were skeptical of this, Ed Riggs being the other. But Julie Eisel pointed out, she's the mayor pro tem, that in other cities where this approach, this new approach, had an impact, they have unified government. We do not. We have city, we have county, we have state, all having a piece of the pie here. And she says that all of this suggestion that came up at council on Monday night sounded frustratingly familiar.
This is like Groundhog Day, because we have the Homicide Task Force report from 2005. We have the Criminal Justice report from 2008. They've made all of these recommendations, and here we are again talking about the same things on a different day. So when's it going to change?
So council is going to get together, and I think a committee on council is going to come up with strategy based on this new approach. But how divided is council over this? Is it just Ed Riggs and Julie Eisel who are a little skeptical?
My hunch is they'll be able to reach a consensus and back most of what's being proposed. Mayor Lyles is pretty good about counting votes in advance. So I wouldn't be skeptical so much of the ability to come up with a plan and to back it. But I do think it's notable, for example, we were talking before the show, Julie Eisel, who has essentially built her political career on public safety.
Because she was a victim of violent crime.
I mean, it was violent.
Right. And she is now, and we've really heard very little discussion about this, she's not even on the public safety committee. It's been renamed, but she's not even on that committee anymore. And that's a bit of a head scratcher, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, she was chair of the, before they reorganized the committees and melded, I think, three into one. She was chair of the Public Safety Committee over several administrations. So, you know, one would think you would like to have that expertise on this particular topic.
Go ahead, Katie.
I admittedly was not at the meeting on Monday, but I was a little bit surprised at, they did, seems like they proposed like some community involvement programs, you know, after school type things to, you know, nip problems in the bud before they become you know, really big. But I was surprised at some of the listed, like, solutions and the lack of focus on guns. There was, I believe, 80% of the homicides last year were committed by firearms. I'm actually surprised it's that low. But the only solution to deal with that on their list was firearm access laws. That's not something that city council can do.
Right.
So I'm curious to know what exactly is going to be done about the gun problem. And it seems like that would be, I don't know, it
and
seems like
that
would
people,
be a priority.
We have victims and victims' family members talking about the ease, like this week, the ease and ability of teens to get guns.
Well, and you remember in the fall there was that series, I think the Observer did the series of stories about the lack of convictions, in essence,
right,
for people caught with weapons. And you heard Governor Cooper and some other Democratic lawmakers in particular saying that, you know, again, judges and prosecutors, there's so many things that go to the state level. And I haven't heard much on the local level. Tark McCarry mentioned it, but the local level of how are they going to unify and coalesce and try and really put some pressure on the legislature?
Well, I was going to say just one little final point that we mentioned, you know, change as far as city, county, and all these different agencies. And one of the things we were hearing last year was the chief coming out and saying he wanted to that the violent criminals, repeat offenders getting bond is a big part of the problem. Well, we just saw yesterday one of the suspects in Kendall Crank's murder was denied bond. So maybe there is some change that's coming about.
So lest we give the impression that everybody was skeptical about this, Spectrum News found at least two people who were not. They were two people who were happy about this and were encouraged about this. Sylvia and Michael Smith, who lost their 23-year-old son Samuel Stitt to gun violence here last year.
It's refreshing and it's encouraging to see that the city has such a strong commitment to eliminating the violence that's going on in the city.
It's going to take grassroots organizations. It's going to take common everyday citizens making a stance to bring about some change.
Are they representative of people in the audience at the council on Monday night, or do you know? Would that be fair to say, or would that just be extrapolating?
I don't really know. I came in briefly at the end. I don't really know how many victims' families were actually there.
I don't know either.
I didn't see very
many. It was just a dinner meeting, so no, there was no real public input.
So Rebecca Hefner, the city's data and analytics director, told council that 25% of homicides last year resulted from an argument, and that is increasingly the case when it comes to these homicides, and that these violent crimes related to arguments that they tend to spread like a contagion. I'm not sure why that I understand that comment, but that's what she says. Is this really news? I mean, hasn't Chief Kerr-Putney been talking about this forever?
Yeah, I mean, I think he has. I think there probably is some value, at least, in putting specific numbers out there and raising more awareness of the public, because not everybody is following this day to day of what's happening and just how severe the problems are. But again, I don't think any of it was really shocking.
These four areas that they identify, these hotspots for crime, Bates Ford Road and LaSalle, Sugar Creek Road 85, Central Avenue and North Sharon Amity, Nations Ford Road and Arrowwood. We've known about these places for a long time. Have we just been ignoring it? What is this new pinpointing of hotspots do for us?
I mean, the deputy chief was clear that they have not been ignoring it, and he was talking about in some areas, I think with the 13 hotel cluster, you know, there has been state, local, federal work on this, but it is just very difficult to solve, obviously.
Okay. Aside from college at trade being closed, We have
very frustrating
other things to talk about. Well, you made it. We have other things to talk about, including a new Panthers head coach. We'll get to that when we come back in just a moment. It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We've got four reporters around the table, always a dangerous room to be in. Steve Harrison, reporter for WFAE News and co-host of our new Inside Politics podcast, which premieres on January 23rd. Katie Peralta is here from the Charlotte Agenda, Jonathan Lowe from Spectrum News, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. And one more question before we move on from what we've been talking about, which is the new approach the city wants to take toward crime. Deputy Chief can't think of his name.
Gerald Smith.
Gerald Smith told council that the police need the help of other leaders in the community. He said law enforcement and CMPD cannot do it ourselves. That's something that Chief Putney has been saying now for years. Rebecca Hefner, the city's data and analytics director, laid out a framework. She says city council should use a combination of collaborative partnerships backed by data and comprehensive social services to curb violent crime and focus on the most at-risk populations. Well, social services are the county's purview. They run social services. But isn't the city and CMPD, haven't they been involved now for a long time with citizen groups trying to get a handle on this? How is this different?
Yeah, I mean, I think if there is a big difference, it is trying to be more pinpoint with analyzing exactly what the results are from these various programs. There were a number of existing programs that they put up on the screen and said, we do this, we do this, we do this, but we don't have rigorous analysis of what the results are.
Yeah, they had a kind of two columns, and they had all these programs like Eric talked about, and they would list them as, quote, best practices, right? We all hear that all the time. And so the idea was like, well, that's just what people think is a good idea. And then they had this other category of, is there any evidence behind them? And then there was no check mark behind those because we have no idea. But again, I'm not sure how you ever find any evidence whether the mayor's youth employment program, what that does. I mean, I don't know if you can ever find the evidence.
I do think, though, that when they talked about things like in-home visits, like an intervention program in St. Louis that apparently has been pretty effective, of trying to head off quarrels, antagonism, people who are familiar with the neighborhoods and kind of understand the issues, trying to intervene. That seems like that could have some potential. I think they were also very careful to say that it is not going to be one aspect of a program or one branch of government or one branch of the police. It very much is an attempt to try and get everyone in the community to participate in this, and obviously that takes a lot of work.
Okay, moving on. David Tepper, the owner of the Panthers, just a few weeks ago or days ago, seemed not terribly keen on going to colleges to find a head coach. But lo and behold, our new coach, Matt Rhule, comes from Baylor. He was the Baylor head coach, and it seems that the defensive coordinator is going to be coming from Baylor as well. They offered him a job on the basis of one meeting at his home in Waco, Texas. How surprising is that choice?
Well, Matt Rhule was inevitably going to get an NFL head coaching job, but you're right, Mike. David Tepper did seem to be leaning in the direction of someone with NFL experience, and the Panthers had interviewed an NFL assistant and a former NFL coach who has since been hired by the Dallas Cowboys. And this seemed to have all the hallmarks of a David Tepper decision. That is, he went down to Waco, and he decided this was who he wanted, and he wrote a really big check because Matt Rhule now is the sixth highest paid NFL coach. This is a guy who's not only never been an NFL head coach, he only had 1 year as an NFL assistant, and even with his success in college, he never won a national championship or even a conference championship.
The other five coaches are New England's Bill Belichick, Seattle's Pete Carroll, Oakland's John Gruden, New Orleans' Sean Payton, and Baltimore's John Harbaugh.
What do they all have in common?
A lot of money.
Super Bowl ring.
They've all won Super Bowls. Yeah. Why did he do this?
Well, I think that
can I apply? I know nothing. I'll apply.
He was obviously very confident. This is a young coach. He's going to turn 45 this month, and he wanted to have him long term. And don't ever overlook the factor of others wanting him. He was supposed to interview with the New York Giants this week, and instead he got a big check from the Panthers.
Wasn't there some interesting reporting about how that all played out, though?
Yes.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he being Matt Rhule, held out the Panthers and then tried to get more money from the Giants, and that didn't. But they ended up, like, right away going to somebody else anyway?
Supposedly, he asked the Giants to match. I have no idea what their response was, but I don't blame him. Like, you can ask around,
well,
right?
There's his answer, Katie, you'll appreciate this, or you probably heard it, was, well, my agent was talking to a lot of people. That means.
But Tepper carried his luggage. They were coming back from a family vacation. Tepper was sitting in the driveway waiting for him to come back. And you write that My pen just broke. You write that...
I did not write that your pen just broke.
No, but you wrote that David Tepper carried his luggage into that.
Yeah, that was a big part of the press conference. They were talking about this, about how the Panthers contingent gets to the driveway, I guess at the same time as the Rule family pulls in from Mexico, and they help take in the luggage, and then they go have snacks inside and spend 5.5 hours in conversation, and by the next day, he's the head coach of
now,
the Carolina
Panthers. Did they know who it was? Just pulling up at their house?
I think there were a couple of phone calls maybe that alerted them as to
I think what's interesting is that, I mean, in the NFL, you can only, there's a salary cap. You can only pay the richest man in the NFL, David Tepper, can only pay his players so much. But there's no salary cap on so many other things, how much you pay your coach, your facilities. And he's shown, you know, by moving to South Carolina, he'll spend whatever it takes to get any sort of advantage.
Right. And it'll be interesting to see with combines coming up quickly and who, you know, how much freedom Matt Rhule gets to pick his coaching staff.
As we said, he's the sixth highest paid coach now in the NFL, and that means he's making $62 million. How many of you are making that? $62 million.
I don't want to brag, but you know.
Over 7 seasons. And when he arrived here, he sounded like, and I would too, that he was all in and ready to hit the ground running.
I will work tirelessly each day to bring you guys a championship, to bring you a championship, because that's what this region deserves, and that's what the players who came before us deserve, and that's what the guys in that locker room, as I've had a chance to meet them, that's what they deserve.
Okay, so tell us about this guy. He did work in the NFL once, right?
Yes. He was an assistant coach with the New York Giants in 2012, but he's built his pedigree in college football, particularly the last 7 years at Temple and Baylor, where he inherited, in both cases, disastrous programs and turned them into winners quickly. So,
is that part of the reason they chose him, because he can turn
around
football teams?
Yeah, because he's been a quick turnaround artist. He's known as a player's coach, good at motivating players. And I think one of the things that really stood out the other day is he used the words process and alignment multiple times. Those are the same words that Tepper has been using throughout this search. Tepper loves analytics. He loves, as Steve said, the idea of sports medicine and rehab and training advantages.
This guy's really into sports medicine.
Really into it. And as you recall, Atrium Health is going to build a big sports medicine center as part of the new $200 million team training complex in Rock Hill. So I think in a lot of ways their philosophies dovetailed, obviously, which is what led to his hire. But it's also interesting that they tamp down expectations. Tepper said in a little scrum with us afterwards, he said something to the effect of, well, sometimes you have to tear something down to build it back up. And Matt Rhule said something to the effect of, well, if we're 8-8, we want to be the best 8-8 team or the best 10-6 team. So nobody's saying it's off to the playoffs in 2020. They're saying if the process, and that word was used a billion times, if the process is followed, if we work the way we think we can, then championships will follow.
Is Ron Rivera not a process and analytics guy?
Process guy, probably. Analytics, a little bit less so. But look, these are all buzzwords being thrown around. The crux of the matter is, David Tepper paid $2.3 billion for this franchise. He's going to want his own guy.
So now, I don't know anything about football at all. Okay? Nothing. Except I know it's on television.
That's pretty well on television.
But when you rebuild a college football program, you do it by changing the attitude and the expectations, and I guess process goes into that. And you also do it through recruitment. There's some recruitment, I suppose, in the NFL, because you got to talk players into coming to your team. But the bottom line is the bottom line. It's money. Is there money out there to do what needs to be done?
Well, I mean, as Steve said, first of all, you have a salary cap. So, you know, most of these teams are at least in the same general neighborhood in terms of their payroll. It's really a matter of how are you drafting? And remember, the general manager, Marty Herney, is staying. He was inherited. Now, David Tepper has also said an assistant general manager will be hired, and what the responsibility sharing is, we don't know yet. But I don't think if you're a Panther fan that you should be worried about David Tepper skimping on investment in what's needed to succeed. But look, all these guys are rich that own these teams. So it's much more than that. It's, do you have the right coach? Can you go out and get the right players? And you don't know that until they get on the field.
I was going to say, this is related, but I'll get back to that directly. But David Tepper, since he took over as owner, he has basically hit Control-Alt-Delete on the business side and completely changed things. He's added his own staff on the business side. He recently landed an MLS team, as we know. He's landed millions of dollars in public funds to support various facilities across the Carolinas. And at the beginning, he was like, let's see what the football side of things looks like, you know, after a few years. He gave Rivera a chance. And now this is his way of saying, all right, we tried, you know, it's time to really start winning on the football side. And as far as like recruitment is concerned and creating a culture that people want to be in, I think that those two things together are what they're banking on will make the franchise really competitive. Now, that's not just the football operations. It's not just having a coach that's a player's coach like Ron Rivera. Everybody loved him. It's also having facilities that are not falling apart. It's not running sprints in the convention center.
Are our facilities falling apart?
Well, they didn't have indoor facilities before at all.
NFL standards, they have been subpar.
Right.
Okay.
So they see investment on the other side as absolutely.
I was going to jump in about the Matt Rhule press conference. I think one thing that was interesting was he was asked, of course, about Cam Newton, asked about the team and the roster, and he just wouldn't give any sort of indication of what he thinks about his players, what he might do. And I've seen a lot of these press conferences with the new coach. The new coach will often kind of say, here's what I think we're going to do. Here's what I like about this new team. Here's where we need to get better. And Matt Rhule would not say anything. And it was almost like I felt like he was kind of like looking at Tepper like, can I say this? Or what do you want me to say? You know.
Well, he did say that he hadn't really had an opportunity to talk to Panthers manager Marty Herney or to David Tepper about a long-term vision. Can that really be true?
What's funny about that is they spent the bulk of the press conference talking about how they spent 5.5 hours talking about how they would do things and how they all were aligned.
Long-term vision?
Yeah, singing from the same hymn sheet. But I guess some of that was the specifics. For example, I think Matt Rhule mentioned, well, I've only watched 3 or 4 or 5 games of the Panthers season, which I guess he had done, you know, Monday and Tuesday. And the other thing is the NFL, it's so cloak and dagger all the time. All of these teams seem to operate like a spokesperson for the CIA. They can't say anything about anything because it would jeopardize, you know.
Well, he said he didn't,
third and eight
he didn't
in
want
September.
To speak out of school, meaning he wanted to let David Tepper speak for himself. But he said he had a chance to talk with Cam and that he has the utmost respect for Cam. But he said, I would much rather talk to those guys, meaning Herney and Tepper, and kind of get a feel for not just Cam, but all those players on the roster and really have a good process moving forward for the entire roster. Can we read anything between the lines? He's not saying anything. He's not saying Cam's my guy.
Yes.
He's also not saying Cam is going, but that's the biggest decision he has to make.
That is. I think the answer to everything is process. Like, that's just the answer. It's like, what day is it? Process. but you're right. He's not saying anything because it's a $21 million salary cap hit, and that decision is going to go far beyond the head coach.
So when a new player comes up from the college ranks to the NFL, you always hear the commentators on TV and radio talking about the difficulty of the transition from being a college player to being an NFL player. Can the same be said of coaches?
We are assured by the forefathers at the Kremlin that everything will be fine. It's all over the place. It has been a rough transition for a lot of coaches. Tepper and Herney the other day said that they are entirely confident, which obviously they are. They wouldn't hire him. We're going to find out, Mike. I mean, none of these things are sure things, and that's kind of a milquetoast answer, but it's the truth.
Okay. I think with just going back to that, with usually the biggest problem when college coaches go to the NFL or whatever professional league, that they're used to coaching and in a way kind of bullying 19-year-olds.
Right.
They have total control
and teaching.
Teaching, but also just like they have complete control and you can and you know, some of the rah-rah stuff and the threats of discipline. You get to the NFL, I mean, these guys are 26, 27, 30 years old. They're professionals. And I think you often hear this so many times that just players start tuning out. You know, tell me what to do. Put me in the right, you know, let's have a great plan. Tell me what to do. I'm a professional. And so that's, I'm not saying that's going to be an issue here.
That's the challenge.
It's a new way of approaching things because these guys are all millionaires, most of them. Okay. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson was in town this week, and he used Charlotte as a backdrop to announce a new rule that he says will increase housing choices for families. What would this new rule do?
So it's under the Obama administration, there was they required cities to show more aggressively that they were working to desegregate their housing. And this will roll that back. And Ben Carson says that he says that it will it'll just when you can when we allow people to build housing wherever, we'll have more housing. Mm-hmm. Housing prices will be cheaper. And it's interesting because this is national policy, but this has kind of played out in Charlotte a little bit, right? Because for 10 years ago, Charlotte's big push was breaking up concentrations of poverty, not building affordable housing in the same places over and over again. And in the last few years, Charlotte's kind of done a little bit of that and said, we're going to build it wherever we can.
Is that why he came here to unveil this rollback? Because I asked the mayor about this, and she wasn't invited. Nobody.
No, because that's the striking thing.
Nobody was invited.
Involved in housing in a city that's obsessed with affordable housing. None of them are there when the HUD secretary
appears. So why did they use us? He could have done this in D.C. Yeah. From his office.
I don't know. It's really right.
Maybe it has something to do with RNC.
Well, he told the crowd that, quote, cities like Charlotte, low-income areas were actually redlined out of affordable housing development plans, and federal resources were neglected or redirected to high-income areas. The term redlining has traditionally been used to refer to discriminatory housing mm-hmm. practices to keep minorities out. Is his characterization of redlining here accurate? Is it true?
I can't give you I'm not enough of a housing expert to say how true his statement is, but the use of that language is, I think, highly offensive and inflammatory
but deliberate.
To a lot of people.
One would
very
think
deliberate.
It's deliberate.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, that, as you said, the history of that term is completely ugly, mm-hmm. and the fact that he used it to kind of flip around the argument, I know, has offended a lot of people that are trying to build more affordable houses.
Is this just more of a bizarro world that we're living in right now?
Yes.
Up is down,
yes.
Black is white?
It sure felt that way.
Okay. We have a few more things to talk about this, including the fact that the mayor wasn't invited to this, in just a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Did you know that Charlotte is hosting the Republican National Convention? It's true. And on January 23rd, WFAE is launching Inside Politics, a new podcast hosted by Steve Harrison and me, Lisa Wharf, about the RNC and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to the trailer and subscribe to Inside Politics now on NPR One and WFAE.org/InsidePolitics.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. Jonathan Lowe is here. That's how I know. He's a reporter anchor for Spectrum News. Katie Peralta is with the Charlotte Agenda. Eric Spanberg, Charlotte Business Journal Managing Editor. And Steve Harrison, a reporter for WFAE News and the co-host of our upcoming Inside Politics podcast. We were talking about Ben Carson, the Housing and Urban Development Secretary, being here this week to announce the elimination of the 92-part fair housing survey, which will then relax where subsidized housing can be built. It essentially rolls back everything the Obama administration did in this area. He said that mayors of cities generally know their city's housing needs better than the federal government. And he added that cities around the country were asking HUD for these changes. So yesterday, when the mayor was on this program, she had not been asked. She didn't even know that he was coming to town to be part of this. I asked if Charlotte was among those cities asking for these changes. She said no. In fact, our mayor wasn't invited to the presentation, and she also took issue with that redlining comment that I mentioned a minute ago.
Today, if you look at our housing framework, we've got housing being built in the center city. We've got housing built on Sugar Creek Road. We've got housing throughout this community.
So he's wrong?
Well, I don't know where he, what information, maybe he's just not current. That might be one of the things.
But he came here to make that announcement, and he specifically talked about Charlotte, and you're telling me he doesn't know what he's talking about?
No, I didn't say that. I said he may not be up to date with what we've been doing. We've been at this affordable housing program since the 70s, but I think that this city council should take a lot of credit for moving more quickly to actually see real change and results.
So some fear that these changes will water down fair housing protections. Does our housing authority, which is now known as Inlivion, do they share those concerns, or do we even know?
Well, I wanted to first point out that no one from Inlivion was there either. Also, Pamela Weidman, who runs the city's housing agency, housing division, was not there either. So, I mean, it goes.
Who was there?
It goes just beyond the mayor.
The limo driver?
it is a bizarre sequence of events.
Jeez. Okay. Well, thankfully, we're heading toward the 2020 elections, because that'll fix everything.
Yeah, this should calm things down.
And on Tuesday night, Mecklenburg County commissioners voted 8-1 to buy new electronic voting equipment and have it in place by the March 3rd primary. We had a choice, I believe, of 3 different approved machines approved by the state. Which machines did we choose to buy and why, Steve?
We are going to use the system in Mecklenburg County starting in March in the primary. A voter will take a blank card, insert it into a ballot machine. You will vote by touchscreen, kind of like you do now. Then the machine will print out that card with kind of barcodes and also the ability for you to see who you voted for. You will check that and say,
how do we know the barcodes is what we voted for?
Well,
how do we know that?
Right. That's kind of the question.
What genius came up with this idea?
Well, I will say this. So this was a little bit of the debate on Tuesday night, whether some other counties, the more low-tech system is just simply where you fill in the bubble. You fill in the oval with a pencil.
And there are problems with that, too.
Correct.
Chads and not filling in the bubble.
Right. Anymore. I mean, I covered the Florida recount 20 years ago, and goodness, 20 years ago. Sorry. Just
took your breath away, didn't it?
He blacked out for a second.
And so the idea is,
only 30 years old. That's the amazing part.
If you're filling in ovals, you're going to have, people are going to fill in only a part of an oval. And then in a close election, the Board of Elections is going to have to decide, did this person really mean to do this, et cetera. And so under this system, in theory, if it works, it is black and white. There is no debate as to who did what.
So we insert the card into the voting machine. We vote electronically with the touchscreen. They take the card out. We take it to another machine, which tabulates based on the barcode. Mm-hmm. Is this really better than the old touchscreen machines that had a paper tape that said exactly what we did, and you could see it come up in the window below you when you pressed the touchscreen? Is it really better than that? Safer than that?
Yes, in that the machines we've been voting on had that kind of receipt, right?
Right.
That you talked about.
Right.
So the only thing you can do with that receipt is count it by hand. So this allows you to do an electronic count with your paper, and then also do the hand count to look at the.
And the elections director says that these systems cannot be hacked, at least the one that Mecklenburg County has chosen.
So,
because all the counties across the state have done something different.
Yes, some of them have gone to paper ballots, strictly paper ballots. And you reported, Steve, that Marilyn Marks with the Coalition for Good Governance spoke out against these new machines that we chose because touchscreen machines, she says, violate the basic concept of don't put a computer between the voter and the ballot. And Michael Dickerson, who is the elections director, has another point of view on that. What is it?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I thought you were about to play Michael Dickerson say something. I'm like, all right, let's hear it.
He was thinking about Florida in 2001.
At 20-year thing.
I'm sorry. So, like Jonathan said, that he says that the system that they use, the computers they use, it's like a closed system. They are not connected to the internet, and so there's no way to get in them.
The computers that design the barcodes?
That design the barcodes.
Well, somebody has to decide what the barcode looks like. So, I mean, what designs that? Do those machines touch the internet?
I guess the idea is that on election day, they are all remote and they are all on their own. Mm-hmm. That they are not. There is no connectivity at the different precincts and the polling places.
Skullduggery can happen at any point in the chain. All right. Well, we'll talk.
What a
Michael
cynical
Dickerson.
Host we have.
I am.
He tried to lead the witness. I heard in that mayor clip. I mean, you got a lot going on over there, Mike.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Elaine Powell was the lone no vote on this on these new machines. Why? Why did she vote no?
She just asked during the meeting a couple questions about kind of what Marilyn Marks asked about the technology and whether, and then she didn't really give a big elaborate answer as to why she voted no, but it seemed to be the question of whether having this touchscreen at all is vulnerable and whether it's the best best way forward.
We'll get Michael Dickerson on the program. We'll do that. The new Mecklenburg County budget goes into effect on July 1st. Get ready. It's just under 6 months from right now, and work on that budget always begins right after the previous budget was put into place, and so they're in the midst of it. There's a new process, though, this year for creating the budget, and it includes voters. How so, Jonathan?
So this is actually the second year that they're doing. It's called the Resident Budget Priority Survey. You can complete it online. It comes in. They expanded it this year. It's 100 different languages that can be filled out online. They also have paper versions that you can get from the county's 19 libraries, three senior centers, and the county community resource center.
And they're seeking input on what you think the priorities for spending should be.
Basically, where do you want them to spend money? They say, you know, this is like the second year. They did this last year, came up with several priorities, and they will say that the county manager directed $65 million of the budget towards those priorities. It was like reduce racial disparities, affordable housing, mental health, parks and greenways. So this year they're asking the same thing. Go online. They've got a list of the priorities, and it's those along those same lines: affordable housing efforts, some of the county health services, and then one thing that is new this year: you can actually play with their budget simulator and submit, so you can do your own budget from home and submit that to the county as well. All of that information, I just checked with the county, they've got more than 2,400 people that have done it, that have completed it online. There's no, they won't know how many have done it, the paper version, until after. There's a lot of engagement. Last year, I think they had like something like 1,500, 1,600 people who did it.
That's not a lot in a county this size. So you tell
Correct.
Me, how do people find out about this? I didn't know anything about this, and I kind of follow things. So how do you find out about this, and where do you go to participate?
So they've got it right smack dab on the homepage of the county website.
What is that?
MECNC.gov, I believe.
Okay.
You go online, you fill the survey out, that way, like I said, you can go to, you know, one of the county libraries, but they had a deadline it was supposed to be, the 8th, which was Wednesday. They have extended that to Monday, so people have more time.
I had a question about that because I did a lot of reading on this yesterday, and all I could find was this date, January 7th. And I thought, well, that's the opening date, because on the 28th of January, they're going to be meeting about the results of this survey. But then I thought, no, what I just read said it's a one-day survey, January 7th. What's the story here?
So the way the process, on the 7th, they had a budget public hearing. So during the county commission meeting, it was a regular meeting, they had a portion in there for people to come up and give their opinions on how money should be spent. So initially, the public hearing was going to be Tuesday. Wednesday was going to be the last day for the survey. They have extended that to Monday. So all of that information will be compiled and given over to the commissioners for their retreat, which is at the end of the month, the 29th and 30th.
What's to prevent me from going on there, and I'm talking about me now,
yes,
and taking the survey multiple times? I have a free weekend this week.
Well, I would think, I haven't asked that specific question, but I would think that the county, tracks IP addresses.
Okay.
They use the new voting machines to track this.
I'll say one more thing about the budget survey. I mean, last year, like Jonathan said, they did this last year, and it was a bit of a, there was a mild backfire on it, because remember when we did the quarter cent sales tax for the arts, and so, you know, pushing how important this is, et cetera, et cetera. And then the opponents were like, hey, we just did a budget survey. No one said the arts is that important. Anyway, it's important.
Well, maybe they'll hear about that now since that failed.
All right. Last Friday, there was a surprise announcement involving the closure of Legacy Preparatory School in East Charlotte. Parents were informed Friday of last week. Schools were to have started this past Tuesday. And Stacy Rose, who was the principal of a Legacy Preparatory School, told WFAE News they just couldn't keep going.
I know a lot of the contention has been, why did you wait to the last minute? Because we really were waiting to the last minute to see if a miracle or something would come out of this.
So why the closing, and why did the school wait so long to inform parents?
They had their charter revoked because of performance. And
as a charter school?
Yes.
But then they became a private school.
Well, they had secured a private investor at some point, and it's my understanding that they were counting on some infusion of money that never came. And I think the principal, or whoever that, was that the principal who just...
Yes.
Spoke. Oh. So she had said something along the lines of, we had depended too much on this investor and
didn't happen.
Well, which I certainly don't think that they anticipated such an abrupt closing, because they're left with, what, 143 or 145 kids scrambling to find a classroom.
And 135 of the 145, 135 of them received opportunity scholarships, which are awarded to schools on the students' behalf to allow these students to attend private schools. What happens to that money?
That's a good question.
Okay. Meanwhile, Mecklenburg County charter schools continued to grow in enrollment, which now stands at 21,028. That's 1,644 students higher than anticipated. What kind of burden does this put on CMS? Because they fund these schools.
Right. This also comes at a time when CMS enrollment itself is either flat or declining. So they're trying to figure out what to do with, you know, this surge that they weren't exactly anticipating. I think they went, at the same, from 1550 budgeted students increased to 1644 or something like that. I think this is a trend that's nationwide. This isn't just CMS. And dealing with it is something that Ernest Winston is the new CMS superintendent. He has a very full plate, as we've heard, and I think that this is certainly a top priority for him.
Last summer, Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools rolled out a new look and a new website, got new logos, new colors, a new website. But over the winter break, after spending $200,000 on that new site, CMS had only one thing to say about it.
Goodbye.
So what happened?
You just played the AOL sign-off,
right.
Mike.
Well, it's better than You Got Mail. That's what happened.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, I'm cringing in my chair. That was awful.
Wow. We had hanging chads, and now we've had AOL.
So oh, my gosh.
People didn't like it. They got mail. They got mail about this because people didn't like the website. They found it difficult to but according to CMS Chief of Staff Latarja Henry, WeAreCMS.com debuted as part of a marketing push designed to convey the school system as, quote, honest, approachable, and transparent. Wait, are we talking about CMS here, transparent, really? Henry said that people found it difficult to use this website. In what way?
It was a clunky user interface, for instance. Navigation was tough. The search was tough. When parents were looking for things like school assignments.
Or the handbook,
really basic everyday functions that you need.
I remember trying to find the handbook several times.
That's something that should be absolutely the easiest part.
So a vendor named Edlio, E-D-L-I-O, set this up. And they paid them money to do this. And after spending $237,500, they decided to shut this down. The system was scheduled to pay Edlio $135,000 a year to keep it up and running. Well, they don't have to pay Edlio any penalties for early termination. But they said that what we came to know very clearly is that what we needed the system to do for us, Edlio wasn't equipped to do for us. Is this another example of a lack of due diligence over there at CMS?
These things are supposed to be figured out on the front end. I think all of us have probably been part of a website rollout that was done preemptively, and there are kinks along the way, but somebody got a bonus for early rollout. I'm just using it as an example. But I think that sometimes these things are pushed out because there's a deadline.
Okay.
So perhaps the due diligence wasn't done beforehand.
Well, you get the last word. Katie Peralta from the Charlotte Agenda, senior
Let's say goodbye.
Editor there. Yes. Jonathan Lowe, reporter anchor for Spectrum News.
Happy New Year.
Wears great ties.
Thanks, Mike.
Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, and Steve Harrison, reporter and co-host of Inside Politics here at WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour.
Goodbye.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.